manufacturing dropping. Now, it's the lowest since reported in 2016.
Speaking of slowing down, there's new data out from China. Not good for the Chinese economy at all. The Chinese economy certainly weakening. That's what the factory data showed. Its currency, the Chinese yuan, falling 2.5% so far this month.
JP Morgan is predicting that the Federal Reserve will slash interest rates this year following President Trump's threat to impose tariffs on Mexico.
We do not know how or when these issues will be resolved. We are closely monitoring the implications of these developments for the U.S. economic outlook.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Fed chairman and several Fed governors come out this week hinting at possible rate cuts that could begin this summer. The market loved that. And on Friday, we got a jobs picture that was much weaker than expected. That's helping to rally stocks, as everybody believes those rate cuts could be coming much sooner. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Jonathan Krinsky will be joining me. He says we're probably stuck in a trading range until we get some clarity on some of these uncertainties out there, whether it's the trade policy, trade wars, or possible rate cuts. He says you need to take a barbell approach. Rob Bernard will join us here as we take a look at why interest rates have been declining and why they're negative overseas. And of course, Chris and I will talk about who has it right, the bond market or the stock market in the big picture. All of that coming up in today's program.
And now it's time for our CEO, Ryan Poplava, to shed some light on the events that moved the markets this week. Ryan, I was pleased to hear some good tariff-related news. It sounded like the Trump administration was going to delay tariffs on Mexico, saying that there were positive developments with the negotiating team, and the market responded positively to that. But what else happened this week?
Thanks, Chris. I've been talking a lot to my brother lately about how one-directional this market has been. And, you know, if you're nimble and able to discern the inflection points, it's a good environment for active managers. And the first talking about inflection points was the Powell put back in January that the Fed could be patient. Additionally, they added more to that with discussion of winding down their balance sheet normalization policy by September. And the second inflection point was the breakdown of trade negotiations between the U.S. and China and the step up in tariffs as a result. This week could have been the third pivot we've seen with the Fed Open Mouth Committee, as John Loeffler used to call it. A few Fed officials this week intimated that a rate cut or accommodative tilt may be in order. So let's take a look at it. Monday, several issues were plaguing U.S. stocks. The Chinese wrote a white paper that placed blame on the breakdown in negotiations on the U.S., which wasn't new, but it reinforced the trade dispute could be an issue that gets drawn out for an extended period of time. Secondly, there was a couple articles on Monday that suggested the Department of Justice was considering a probe of Apple and Google to see if they were using their size to act in an anti-competitive manner. And then the Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC, was given jurisdiction to take a look into Amazon and Facebook. And that leaves only Netflix as the only FANG stock not mentioned under regulatory scrutiny. Interestingly, the market wasn't down overall much based on weakness in these key stocks. And that's when St. Louis Fed President Bullard, a voter on the committee, he kind of started the Fed speak train, stating a rate could maybe be warranted given just the weakness overall and the slide in inflation over the past few months. Initially, the S&P moved up 10 points higher off that remark, but it did start all the commotion and got the media and investors drawing on those conclusions. And which followed was a speech by Jay Powell Tuesday, as well as comments from Chicago Fed President Evans, both voters acknowledging trade uncertainty and low inflation levels. With the combination of dovish comments from the Fed as well as oversold technical conditions following a 6.6% drop in the S&P 500 last month, U.S. stocks were ripe for a rally. Now, to sort of affirm the Fed comments this week, we had weak ADP payrolls, that's private payrolls, of only additional adds of around 27,000 jobs versus expectations for 170,000. Factory orders were down 0.8% in April. The ISM manufacturing peaked in August of 2018 and hit a new fresh low in May at 52.1. Still expanding because it's above 50, but obviously it's been decelerating from the upper 50s and appears on track for, gosh, contraction at this rate. And then there's the ISM services, which did get a tick up, but then Friday's jobs report really only adding 75,000. You know, that was well off the consensus for 182,000. And that really set things in motion for, you know, a real look at the Fed coming into maybe rescue and lower interest rates in the next month or two. The average hourly wage had decelerated slightly to 3.1% year over year. All of this just really seemed to reinforce that consensus. So given where things have gone, I took a look at the Fed futures recently, and they're looking at about a 66% probability that next month we see rates drop 25 basis points. And then if you look at September's predictions, right now there's a prediction of around 54% that rates will drop 50 basis points. I'm definitely seeing a different story when I look at a rise in stocks and a rise in bond prices this week. One of them has to be wrong, or maybe does it. Rates kicked up initially on the stock rally early in the week, but dropped again late in the week on all those poor economic announcements I've already mentioned. I'm seeing some interesting developments right now, given this kind of reflationary yet weak economic footing. And I'm seeing low volatility and bond proxies outperform. That means consumer staples, real estate investment trusts, utilities, and even healthcare are carrying the stock market higher, and they're the ones that are outperforming. So investors should be aware and review with their advisors, as and this may be an inflection point where, you know, stocks, again, with low volatility and sort of bond proxy capabilities based on a lower rate environment while slowing economic expansion, that's the place to be kind of looking at maybe increasing exposure to. And then gold also has been a beneficiary of all the Fed communication this week, and that closed in on its near-term resistance right around 1350, and I believe intraday high on Friday was around 1352. That's it for me, Chris. It should be quiet from the Fed until June 16th, so expect headlines on trade and regulation to be at the forefront until then. And then, of course, we won't have earnings till July. So right now, those headlines are what's guiding the market.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
So we're definitely playing at the high stakes table right now. Doesn't mean we're going to lose at the high stakes table, but you're playing for keeps. And that seems to be what we're doing on a couple of fronts. So the risks are very high. Right now, the rewards are very high as well, too. The risks are something that I don't think we've been accustomed to in the post-crisis period that we're going with right now. So it is definitely a period that is not like what we've seen in recent years, and we'll have to see how this plays out.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well,
Well, the good news this week is stocks are at least on the upside. We've got a bit of a correction going, but will this last before turning down, or will we go back up again? Joining us on the program from Baycrest Partners is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, you had in a recent piece that it was very important for the market to hold at 2725. Here we are above 2800. Does that change your disposition in terms of where this market's heading?
No, Jim, it actually kind of just reiterates how important that was. And the reason we kind of highlighted 2730 on the S&P 500 was if you look at the amount of volume that trades at any given price level on the S&P, and you go back a couple years, the most amount of volume in that period has happened at around 2730. So it's very important. It's not surprising that it acted as good support towards the end of last week. And we did see a nice bounce off that. And as you said, now here we are back above 2800. So I think that is, if you're looking for a level to kind of trade against or to, you know, use as maybe a sell stop or something like that, then 2730 is certainly as good as any from our perspective. You know, now I think we're kind of in a, I don't want to say no man's land, but we've kind of rebounded. We've lost some of the oversold conditions, but there's still a lot of headwinds out there technically and internally that give us somewhat of a pause to expect new highs anytime soon.
So, Jonathan, are we kind of stuck in a trading range? I mean, there's a lot of what I would call political factors that are interfering in the market. On the day you and I are speaking, we thought Mexico was going to have a deal. Then they kind of flipped on that. So we have trade. We have a number of geopolitical factors that seem to be interfering in the market right now.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of cross currents on that front, and there's a lot of cross currents if we're just looking internally and at the market. And I think, you know, one of the big picture thoughts that we continue to look on is if you look across the globe over the last couple of years, most global markets peaked in January of 2018, along with the S&P. And then since that point, there's really only been a handful of global markets that made new highs past January 2018, the S&P being one of them. It did, of course, in September of 2018, and again, a marginal new high in just at the beginning of May of this year before we had this pullback. But even within the S&P, there was only a couple sectors, mainly technology, that led to that new high. So I think it's somewhat of a, I don't know if illusion's the best term, but most stocks around the world have not done much since January of 2018. So I think that's kind of the background that we have to remember. And then if you look back in the U.S. under the surface, some of the issues, you know, if you look at small caps, they continue to underperform. They have a firmly declining 200-day moving average. They're firmly below that. Even as we speak today with the S&P around the flat line, small caps are down nearly 1%. And you take that a step further, you look at the really tiny names, the micro caps, they're even worse. So typically, that's not a great sign for risk. But at the same time, when you have mega large cap names doing well, that can mask a lot of the underperformance and the weak breadth. So it's one of those things where it's hard to say that everything's firing on all cylinders, but it's also hard to get too bearish unless and until some of these mega cap names begin to really roll over.
One of the things that your global breadth and your global markets are indicating, Jonathan, they sort of go hand in hand with what's happened with economic growth, because a lot of the global PMIs have been falling, and along with that, stock markets. Now, the one thing that has been going on here, and of course, we talked about this last year, one of the strong leaders in the market has been technology, and especially the FANG stocks. Let's talk about the FANG stocks. They look like some of these are breaking down. There's talk in Congress about breaking up some of these companies. So when you see a leadership group like that start to break down, does that give you pause?
Yeah, certainly. I think they've had enough of a breakdown to certainly give us pause. They haven't had enough of a breakdown to really drag things over like we saw in the fourth quarter of last year, right? So they're kind of just chopping around in a range. A lot of names in the FANG complex are kind of just stuck on either side of their 200-day moving average, and the slope of that 200-day for a lot of these names is really flat, which also makes things a bit of a headache. It's always kind of whenever you have a flat 200 moving average on any asset class, it tends to give false moves in both directions. So it starts to look weak, and then it snaps back, and then it starts to look strong, and then it pulls back in. So that's kind of what we're dealing with a lot of these mega cap tech names. And, you know, so I think it does give us pause, but it's probably too early to say that they're broken. And it's probably also too early to say that they're resuming their secular uptrend. So it's unfortunately just kind of a range bound situation there. The other interesting part of the market that I think is a bit perplexing, not perplexing, but is standing out to us is the low volatility names, or the high dividend names, your consumer staples, your utilities, your REITs. And a lot of the strength here is because interest rates remain so low, and we can probably talk about interest rates in a bit, but you know, you have a very strong move out of these groups, which again, typically is not a great sign of growth or, you know, of risk on.
Yeah, let's move on to interest rates, because one of the things that you've commented and other technicians have taken notice of is this year, unlike last year, we had rising stock prices and rising interest rates. This year, we've had falling interest rates and rising stocks up until recently. So which market has it right, the bond market or the stock market?
Yeah, and that's one of the tough parts about intermarket analysis. And I think people put too much weight on correlations. And there, as you just mentioned, there's times where stocks and bonds go up together. There's times where they go down together. And there's times where they move inversely. I think right now, the low interest rates are kind of being used by the market as almost a reason to be bullish, at least certain parts of the market. You know, when you have no growth, you get a bid to the defensive names because they have yield, and then you also get somewhat of a bid to the growth names because there is no growth. So I think that's kind of what's happening. If interest rates have come down to a level that we think are probably due for a bounce, a counter trend bounce on the 10-year, I think we got down to, I don't know, maybe 205 on the 10-year. Also interesting, over in Germany, German bonds got right down to a prior level that I believe they saw in 2016, and you know, it's a logical area again for yields to rebound a bit. I think if they don't rebound and you start to see yields break down further from here, let's say the 10-year were to break below 2%, then I think it becomes a scenario where it becomes more concerning, becomes a risk-off type of trade, and that would certainly be something to watch as we go forward. But our sense is that yields do put in the short-term bottom here, and then we'll see if and when how high they can rebound if that happens.
So right now, if you take a look at it, it almost looks like a risk-off trade, whether it's consumer staples, REITs, utilities are doing well, bond yields are doing well. The other area that is doing well is gold. Let's talk about gold now.
Yeah, gold, it continues to kind of hold up relatively well. And I think, you know, even though it hasn't been trending necessarily, I think it continues to put in a decent base. Ultimately, we really probably need to see it get above 1360, 1375, and put in some days above that level to suggest that it's in a new trading range and maybe a new uptrend. But the fact that it continues to hold up well in the face of everything that's going on, I think is constructive. We're also keep an eye on, and it doesn't get much attention of late, but silver, which has actually badly underperformed gold. So that's obviously the reason it hasn't gotten much attention. But if you look at positioning in the silver market, large speculators, their net position is actually almost at all-time lows relative to open interest. So I think the setup could be for, you know, if gold continues to work, I think you're reaching a point where silver should actually probably even start to do a little better, even though structurally it's not in as good of a position, but there certainly could be some catch up from silver. But yeah, gold, I think, continues to act well. And the longer it kind of holds here above 1300 in this range, the more likely it is to eventually break out and maybe move up to 1400, even 1500 in the quarters ahead.
You know, typically there's a seasonality to gold, as there has been in the past, but the summer months tend to be weak for the gold market, strong for the fall. And what we've seen, Jonathan, since probably 2014, we get up into that 1350, 1360 range, and it hits it and then it corrects. So how significant would it be if we were to break out from here? And if we did, where do you think the next level of gold would be?
Yeah, that's definitely the level. And it's, if you've been bullish of it, it's been somewhat frustrating. But also, if you've been bearish, I guess it could be, have been frustrating because it's not really breaking down. So yeah, I think you nailed it, that 1360, 1370, somewhere in there does look like a pretty meaningful breakaway. So we'll see if we can get that. Obviously, the dollar plays an impact as well, and the dollar's remained somewhat firm. So we don't have a strong view here necessarily on the dollar, but if that were to roll over a little even, I think that would help the breakout in gold. So we'll see. You know, maybe we'll get some clarity in the next couple of weeks.
So given the fact that it looks like we're in a trading range, there are a lot of cross currents here from whether what the Fed may or may not do. They're sort of hinting if this trade war gets extended, they may cut interest rates. The futures market is betting that they will cut at least twice. Some say it could come as soon as July. So with all these cross currents, as an investor, what would you be doing?
Well, I think to some extent that diversified strategy probably still makes sense, where you have some growth names, which is largely in the tech sector. Again, given that it seems like there's not a lot of growth out there, but also some interest rate sensitive, some dividend names in the REIT, in the consumer staples, you know, as hard as it may be to buy some of those near their highs, I think, you know, given the secular and structural trend in interest rates that remain somewhat suppressed, I think those names will probably continue to do well over the medium term. If we're talking short term, you know, I think there's probably maybe a little risk there because we see some risk to yield snapping back. But, you know, if you're talking the next 3 to 6 months, I think those names will probably continue to work. But again, there's no predominant trend in most markets, which makes it somewhat difficult. You know, we've been in this range, like I said, for, you know, going back to January 2018, there's really been no progress on the S&P, and a lot of global markets are even lower from there. So unfortunately, it's never easy. It's certainly not easy right now, but I think that kind of barbell strategy is probably prudent at this point.
Jonathan, I want to talk about a market, at least to my recollection, and that is oil. We've had four bear markets since 2017. Oil is in a bear market now. What's your take on oil here?
Yeah, that's another one that, you know, you could throw into the risk-off camp. Obviously, there's some benefits to lower gasoline prices to the consumer, but I think from an intermarket standpoint, when you have oil accelerating to the downside like it has in the last couple of weeks, that's usually not a bullish sign. But it does seem like it's trying to stabilize here. You know, there's definitely some support in the kind of mid-40s if it were to have another leg lower. But our sense is there was a lot of selling done in the crude market, probably neutralize some of the positioning. If we go back to the end of April, speculators were pretty long crude. So, you know, I think this move has shaken a lot of that out. But again, it's there's no trend. Certainly, there's no bullish trend. If you could argue that somewhat neutral to bearish, but I think, you know, it's probably going to be in this high 40s to low 50s for the foreseeable future. And then we'll see what happens there. I think if you take it the next step further as it relates to energy stocks, that's kind of a bigger issue because when oil was going up, energy stocks couldn't really do much. And now that oil's been going down, they're going down with it. So that's usually not a good setup. And energy sector within the S&P is just such a small weighting now. It's just really not that much of an impact. But I think it's just a very difficult sector to invest in right now.
So, Jonathan, if I was to clarify, you're somewhat cautious, at least in the short or intermediate term. And we have so many cross currents and variables right now. So maybe a barbell approach, a little bit of growth, some dividend stocks, and keep it at that.
Yeah, I think that nailed it pretty closely. And again, keep an eye, you know, if things do roll over again, that the lows from late last week, 2730 in the S&P, I think will be very critical as kind of a fulcrum as we head into the rest of the summer.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work at Baycrest, how can they do so?
Well, we are an institutional trading firm. So if you have any institutional clients, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact me through our website, baycrestpartners.com.
All right, Jonathan. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim.
You bet. Back to the trading floor for you.
All right, sir. Take care.
Bye-bye.
our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Now, what caused, again, my emphasis on causality, the growth rate of profits to be so high? First of all, think of normal companies like drug companies and phone companies. For a variety of reasons, it became more and more profitable for them to merge and get big. As you get big, you gain market power, and it's harder to bargain for labor against them, so labor suffered. They got very big. If you remember 1981, the beginning of this period, I think we broke up AT&T into 12 baby bells, or was it 8? I forget. What I know is there are two left, basically Verizon and AT&T. And not surprisingly, they have huge profits. Same in the drug companies. And you have obviously many, many mergers, and you look at the profits of Pfizer and Merck and people, it is absolutely unbelievable. These profits are all known as excess profits. They are levels of profit that cannot happen in a competitive economy.
One of the issues we've been discussing here on the program is the divergence we're seeing in the bond market. Bond yields have been heading down, stocks have been heading up until recently. So what's behind this story? Joining us on the program is Rob Bernard from Financial Sense Advisors. Rob, let's begin with, I guess one of the big stories out there is deflation, disinflation in bonds. What is the message, in your opinion, coming from the bond market?
Well, Jim, there's a lot of controversy between deflation and disinflation. So let's take one at a time. Deflation is falling prices, bad for the economy and stocks, but on the other hand, it's good for bonds. Disinflation is the slowing rate of inflation, which winds up being good for stocks and good for bonds.
Of those two, yields have been falling. It seems to tell me that maybe we're heading towards disinflation?
That's correct, Jim. That's exactly correct. If you go back in time and realize over the past couple of years or so, the Fed has been trying to get a 2% rate of inflation. They have not been successful at that.
So let's talk about how we got here. Because if you would have, let's say, gone back to 2010 when the Fed launched QE, they expanded their balance sheet by $4.5 trillion. You would have expected to see more inflation in the economy. We haven't seen that. Then, a little over a year ago, they began QT, which is quantitative tightening, which still continues even though they're winding it down. So explain the end of QE and the start of QT. What relationship has that had to the bond market and where we stand today?
Well, let's go back to October of 17, when the Fed actually started to shrink the balance sheet by letting securities roll off as they mature and not investing the proceeds. The Fed rate at the time was 1 to 1.25%. And then the Fed sees reduction of the balance sheet as a technical exercise. Actually, this was Janet Yellen that made that comment. But eventually, it would start part of QT as we know today, except the Fed was already raising the Fed funds rate. So in effect, Jim, you had a 2-for-1. Tightening was happening at a much quicker rate than even the Fed thought was possible. So the balance sheet reduction would peak at $50 billion a month. The Fed would raise interest rates 3 times in 2017 and 4 times in 2018.
In effect, what you're saying is they were double tightening. And I have to believe they didn't realize how tight they were getting things, because I want to get to the fourth quarter of last year, where we had strong economic growth leading into Q4. The Fed came off its September FOMC meeting. They talked about, we're not even close to neutral. The market didn't like that. The market peaked in early October. And they continued that story even to the end of the year. By then, oil prices were down 40%. The markets were down. Just about every market fell. And immediately, the first couple of weeks of the year, they turn around and do a flip. So let's talk about the flip. And is the Fed, and is the message of the bond market right now telling the Fed, with yields falling, they're still too tight?
As you so correctly pointed out, the stock market and bond market was starting to get a little antsy the fourth quarter of 18. and the volatility was skyrocketing, the yields were falling, and the Fed was tightening more than they actually realized. The combination of the Fed raising the Fed funds rate as well as QT was not making the market a happy camper. So in December 19, the Fed meeting raised what appears to be now the last time. They also talked about two rate hikes in 19, not much mention of the balance sheet reduction, and still trying to sustain a 2% inflation rate. But now, the Christmas Eve massacre. Yields fall again. The Fed is out of touch. And the stock market hit, I think the day before Christmas was, what, down 700 or 800 points? Ooh.
Yeah.
Bad move.
Yeah, it was the low point. And of course, they didn't do anything after the 24th, but that was the bottom for most asset classes. But then, Rob, we took off at the beginning of the year. Bond yields continued to fall. Stocks began a V-shaped recovery. Assets from oil got all the way up to $65 a barrel. Gold was up, as it is now, and all asset classes went up. But yet the bond market was still continuing to fall. So explain at least your thinking on why that's happening.
Well, it all started on the January 30th Federal Reserve meeting and the dovish comments. And we realized that QT was not on automatic pilot anymore. In 6 weeks, the Federal Reserve did a 180-degree turnaround in their own thinking. It wound up being that the market's turmoil had rattled the Fed. They came out and said no rate hikes in 19. Patience now is part of the Fed's lexicon. Balance sheet reduction went from $50 billion a month to $15 billion a month. And they announced that QT, quantitative easing, was going to, or the balance sheet reduction was going to end in September of 19. But here's the interesting thing. They also said that the mortgage-backed security roll-offs were going to be used to buy treasuries. Whoa, think about that for a second. That, in effect, is quantitative easing? Okay, so which ones were they going to buy? It wound up being that they're going to buy 1 year and earlier of United States Treasury. Now, this is very strange because they now are admitting that they got too tight too fast. Okay, so when you think about it, the LIBOR rate at the end of December was 2.80. That's the three-month LIBOR rate. Today, it's 2.47. That means they're trying to move the front end of the yield curve without lowering interest rates.
And are they trying to get away from what we've seen happen a couple times this year, and that is the inversion on the short end of the curve? So are they trying to influence that directly?
I'm not sure that that's part of their dealing. However, because think about this for a moment. In Europe right now, the 10-year is negative 20 basis points. In Japan, it's negative 11 basis points. Even at our 10-year treasury rate today at 2.12%, it's still a better deal to buy U.S. treasuries than any other security in the world based on yield and security. So think about this for a second. Does the Fed really, they have no control over the long end. They can only control the short end. And if they drop the short end too quickly, that has a whole nother meaning. So I think that just because the 2-10 spread, 2-year, 10-year spread, may go negatively, which it's pretty far away from now, it may go negative, it doesn't mean what it used to mean, because there's too many other areas influencing the long end of our yield curve.
Given where we are now, and this week you had Powell out, you had Bullard out, you had several voting members of the Fed hinting at a possible rate cut. A. Gary Schilling, the economist, he thinks that they could go as soon as this summer, or later this summer, that is, probably in September. You have others in the market saying they could go this month or maybe in July. What's your opinion?
I think it all has to do with what's going to happen with China. If this winds up being a prolonged trade war with China, then I think a rate reduction is clearly on the table. If we get a trade deal, I believe that we will not get a rate reduction. The economy, we all look back at this portion of the slowdown and say it was just that, a slowdown while we're trying to negotiate with the Chinese. However, the bond market, especially the municipal bond market, is telegraphing that they see a rate reduction. Now, it's also rallying because of other tax jurisdictions, of course. But nonetheless, that's what I feel.
If I was looking at the presidential race, I've got one, our existing president, who lowered taxes, lowered income taxes, lowered the corporate tax rates. If I look at the candidates on the other side, they're saying if we get in, we're going to reverse all that and raise taxes even more. How much of that is playing into the bond market? I think it was J.P. Morgan did a survey of their wealthiest clients, and these are people that have net worths of over $35 million. They're moving into munis and strongly into the bond market.
Well, it all has to do with who gets in office. I understand exactly what you're talking about, but overall, tax rates have always been going up as opposed to going down. And due to the loss of the SALT state and local tax deduction and property tax deductions, I mean, you still get to deduct $10,000, but to some people, that's not enough. The municipal bond market provides great return and total return. For example, some of our accounts are up total return close to 9%. It's a 5% tax-free coupon, plus the bonds have appreciated 4, sometimes 5, sometimes even as much as 6%. So the total return for the municipal bond market today is fantastic. Now, if you couple that with a tax-exempt yield, your real yield to your own personal bottom line is probably closer to 15%, 16% on a total return basis. So that's why I think you're seeing an awful lot of talk today about being in the municipal bond. Every time we have a new offering that comes out, it's gone. I mean, and it's oversubscribed sometimes 2 and 3 times. So it is a very popular place to be as opposed to corporates.
All right. So given where we are right now, we've seen rates come down from roughly about 2.7% at the beginning of the year. We're currently around 2.1, as you mentioned, negative interest rates in Europe, negative 20 basis points in Germany, a negative 11 and 12 basis points in Japan. What do you do as an investor in this kind of market if you're looking at bonds?
Well, if you're in that particular tax bracket that needs that need tax-exempt income, buy 5% coupons, buy them 10 to 12 years out, and enjoy the cash flow.
And Rob, if our listeners would like to find out more, tell them how they could do so, please.
Thanks, Jim. They can call me at 858-487-3939 or contact me at rob.bernard@financialsense.com or toll free at 888-486-3939.
All right, Rob, thanks so much for joining us on the program and have yourself a great weekend.
All right, you too, Jim.
One of the issues for the markets this year has been declining bond yields and rising stock prices until recently. And this has been an issue that we've discussed here on the program with many of our experts. And Jim, you interviewed A. Gary Schilling this week on FS Insider. He believes the U.S. economy has entered a possible recession this quarter. Here's a clip of that.
Yeah, well, the thing about recessions is that you never know when they start until they're well underway or sometimes until they've actually ended. It takes time for the data to come in. And then the interesting thing about recessions is that when the data is revised, it's almost always revised down. And the reverse is true at the bottom. Those are two reasons why I think we very well could be in a recession, but we won't know it for months or even quarters.
We also got a weak unemployment report on Friday with job creation dropping to only 75,000 jobs. So the economic numbers, they are beginning to weaken. So for today's big picture, we focus on who has it right, the bond market or the stock market.
Let's begin where we have been. If you take a look at where we are in this Friday, the Treasury note, the 10-year Treasury note, which is also tied heavily to mortgage rates, has fallen from about 2.7% is where we began the year, to today it got down to 2.07. And one of Schilling's contentions is that in the next recession, we could see the 10-year down to 1% and the 30-year down to 2%. Also, let's take the stock market. It went from a low of 2506 to where it is today on this Friday at 2880. So last year, we saw yields and stock prices rise, reflecting a stronger economy, which is what we saw. We got close to 3% economic growth. Now, this year, stocks rose while yields fell, suggesting the economy is slowing, and that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, we did see a blip in the first quarter, which came in much higher than most people were anticipated at a 3.1% rate, but a lot of these, as Schilling points out, were one-time events. It was a result of a build in inventory. Exports increased while imports declined. And of course, they made an inflation adjustment. That is not expected to happen this quarter, as many of the PMIs including the latest ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing report, these two have fallen consistently since last fall. In fact, the current ISM manufacturing report is down to 52.1. Now, I want to point out that anything above 50 indicates the manufacturing economy is expanding, but it's gone from around 60 to where it was in May at 52.1. And as Jonathan Krinsky pointed out earlier, global markets have peaked early last year along with global growth. I guess the question now remains, who is left besides the U.S.?
So it looks like then the bond market has it right. As economic growth here is softening, the Fed is even hinting at cutting interest rates. And if you look at the ISM survey, it continues to weaken. So, Jim, is there the possibility that Schilling could be right and the U.S. has entered into a recession?
You know, I think we're headed into one unless we get a policy reversal here shortly. I mean, interest rates are far too tight, which is the message the markets are sending the Fed, just as they did towards the end of last year. And the problem with the Fed, they never get it right and may remain on the sidelines far too long before actually cutting interest rates. As Schilling pointed out in that clip you played, he goes, a lot of times we don't know we're in a recession until much later as the economic data is revised, and it's usually revised lower. The trade wars are definitely having an impact on global trade. You're seeing prices are rising here, and a lot of retailers and businesses are simply holding down cost, which is cutting into margins, which we're seeing at the retail level. Consumers are increasing savings, which is why retail sales have been so weak, and the tax cuts have not produced the CapEx spending that was hoped for. Now, I want to take a minute here to explain why CapEx spending isn't increasing. Even though corporate tax rates were cut from 35 to 21%, if you are a corporate treasurer, and remember, I want to go back to last year, the Fed is aggressively raising interest rates. What do you know if you're an economist and a treasurer when the Fed is raising interest rates? They usually break the economy. That's number one. Number two, if you are going to be spending money, why would you do that if the demand isn't there? In other words, why go out and build a new factory? And number three, we have all of this political uncertainty, whether it's tariffs or it's the possibility of a complete regime change coming in 2020, where there would be massive tax increases and let's say more regulation. So all of that uncertainty creates a lot of businesses are saying, you know what, I'm not sure where we're going to be a couple of years from now, so why put out the extra effort to spend money? So if we get back to your question on recession, if not now, maybe soon, as the risk for a recession has been raised by several key macroeconomic firms, including some of the big investment firms like Morgan Stanley, which have raised their estimate. The problem is the divergence between bonds and stocks is a real issue, with the stock market, in my opinion, not fully pricing in the downside risk brought on by a trade war or, let's say, an overly tight Fed. Now, there is this delusion. You hear it if you watch the cable channels. Don't worry about a recession. Don't worry about a bear market. The Fed has got the markets back. Well, explain that one when 12 out of 13 recessions were preceded by Fed rate hikes. The problem is there's just too many moving variables, mostly political, that are creating too much uncertainty, which is another reason why business and consumers are holding back, not to mention the election uncertainties, which will have the opposite outcomes for the economy.
Well, and certainly the market does not like uncertainty. We know that. So you did mention the uncertainty, the effects of the uncertainty. How do you boil down the risks of recession then? Because it seems like that's kind of the theme I'm hearing, you know, from even past guests this last week, is risk of recession. How do you define those risks?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of complacency. Yield spreads remain tight. The TED spread is tight. Now, we've seen bank stocks decline, which is usually a harbinger of things to come. And the other thing we're seeing is accelerating global growth slowdown with negative yields both in Japan and Europe. As Rob talked about earlier, we've got negative yields about 20 basis points in Germany, likewise in Japan. And also, as Gary Schilling explained in our interview, actually tariffs and rising prices could actually be deflationary if people are saying, wow, prices keep rising and they hold back on spending, or it takes more to buy the things you need. So there are, one of the things that Schilling pointed out is there are three things that can derail an economy. Some kind of exogenous shock. Think oil, or think of the financial crisis with investment banks and mortgages in 2007 and 8. Excesses, for example, as we saw in the tech bubble and with mortgages. And, of course, central banks. Now, right now, there are several possibilities for shocks. One of them is emerging market debt because of a rising dollar. The second is corporate bonds with triple B bonds and junk. And then third is the trade war, which could become protracted more than the markets are expecting. I asked him in that interview, you know, I said, Gary, if you do think we're in a recession, what kind of recession is this? He said, probably an average recession, which would last three quarters, unless any of those risks, whether it's EM, triple B, or a trade war, escalates. Now, what we can point out to now, what is it that we see? The LEIs are rolling over. As I pointed out, the ISM report is down to 52. It's still expansionary, but job cuts are starting to surface again. We've seen it in the auto industry and also in the industrial goods sector. And according to Challenger Gray and Christmas, they point out the job cuts are the highest that they've seen since 2010, when we were dealing with the 10% unemployment rate. Now, on the global front, the World Bank just lowered again its global growth forecast from 3.6%, a full percentage point, down to 2.6. According to the World Bank, the global economy is at a crossroads with financial stresses, suboptimal business environments, and a great deal of uncertainty, which is hindering economic growth, including the escalating tariff wars. The one thing the markets and economic actors don't like is uncertainty and makes investment decisions harder. And there's plenty of that right now with our present political situation.
Well, it just really seems like such an unpredictable situation. It just seems like it could go any direction. It could go to recession, it could go, or even extension. What needs to happen, though, if a recession is to be avoided? Or do you think this is just really a situation that's too late to rescue?
You know, there are several things that need to happen soon. And when I say soon, I mean soon, not 3, 4, 5, or 6 months from now. And if we are going to see what Schilling thinks is a recession, which began this quarter. Number one, the Fed needs to cut rates as it's been too tight. Yields are still high. I mean, you think of, what are we on this Friday? 2.07 on a 10-year. I mean, that seems very high, believe it or not, when you look at Germany, which is negative 0.2% on a 10-year, or a negative 12 basis points in Japan. Number two, the dollar needs to fall as this takes the pressure off emerging markets, a possible crisis point. It helps corporate profits for the S&P 500 companies, which get over 40% of their sales from overseas, so that could stimulate growth. And quite honestly, the trade wars need to end, and we need to see some kind of clarity on the political front. I mean, it is just getting crazy out there, from free health care to free college, now free homes and free income. And here's a point Schilling brings out. There doesn't have to be a recession. Most of them have been caused by shocks. Think of oil, 1974, 1991. Think of the mortgage crisis in 2007 and 2008. And overly aggressive Fed tightening. I mean, think of last year when we started out, they were going to raise interest rates three times. As the economy picked up, they said they were going to do it four times. September, the Fed gets hawkish. October, they're hawkish. They're hawkish in December, and we saw what happened. So as Schilling points out, 12 of the 13 recessions have been preceded by Fed rate hikes. So what does the market believe in, that the Fed has their back? In other words, there are a lot of people in the market today that say, well, don't worry, the market gets into trouble, they'll just flip, reverse rates, kind of like what they did at the beginning of the year. Just want to mention, all recessions were preceded, with the exception of one, and that was 1974, were preceded by Fed rate hikes.
You know, Jim, I've noticed lately with many of our guest experts, including, by the way, today's technician, Jonathan Krinsky, that they've turned cautious. So, I mean, based on the reality of what we're seeing, what would you say investors need to do right now? I mean, and I guess what I'm really saying is, what can go right and what can go wrong?
Well, let's take the best thing that could happen right now is on the trade front, as this is hurting consumers, it's hurting business and global trade. The next thing would remove some of the uncertainty for what the Fed's going to do. So, for example, maybe a rate cut, winding down QT. But cutting rates would remove some of the issues with the dollar and help on the corporate front, as well as alleviate pressure on emerging market debt. If those things happen, we could stave off a recession. If they don't, we risk the danger of a possible crisis in the EM markets, the corporate debt markets, and the possibility it could be too late when the Fed really begins to cut rates.
So with that reality, Jim, what should investors be doing right now? I mean, should they hold their breath, bite their nails, have a beer, move to a deserted island, buy Bitcoin, buy pork bellies? I mean, what should investors do?
All of the above. That way you can handle any scenario. No, seriously, they should take a cautious stance. Perhaps, as Jonathan Krinsky talked about, a barbell approach. Maybe own some high dividend paying stocks, bonds, some cash in case if things improve to buy or raise more if they don't. What makes this environment so difficult, it has become so politically charged. I mean, how do you predict a tweet or even a Fed flipping 180 degrees in just a matter of weeks? Now, right now, the futures market is predicting a rate cut by July with a 68% probability, another rate cut by September, a 54% probability. Now, the Fed and several key voting members like Bullard this week have hinted at rate cuts coming if things don't improve. And several key strategists have moved their rate cut time frame from September to July. But until it does, I just don't believe you should be aggressive right now with your portfolio. And you should be taking a defensive posture, as I don't believe this is the time to be aggressive.
Well, I know in the past, you've always said that you watch the bond market closely, that the bond guys usually have it more right than wrong, at least compared to the stock market. Do you think that's still the case?
You know, I do. I still believe that if you want to know what's ahead, follow the market and credit spreads and the price of oil, and they will tell you all you need to know about what lies ahead.
Well, speaking of what lies ahead, Jim, what do you see in the weeks ahead?
Well, we've got a Fed rate FOMC meeting coming this month. Nobody's expecting a rate cut, but they could be setting the stage for a rate cut coming as early as July. And of course, we will be ending second quarter. It's going to be interesting to see what happens to corporate profits. Wall Street is still predicting. It's amazing. You get a rising stock market and everybody becomes bullish. They're predicting a 10% increase in earnings this year. We just don't see that happening. But those are the kind of things that we're going to be watching. And of course, at the end of the second quarter, we're halfway through the year. We'll take a look at what happened to economic growth and if our friend Gary Schilling is right, that things are rapidly slowing down. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. We hope you have a pleasant weekend.
We're down Louisiana, close to New Orleans. We're back up in the woods among the evergreen. This little log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Alan B. Good, who never ever learned to trust gold so well, but he could cut interest rates like ringing a bell. Hey, go! Go, Alan, go, go! Go, Alan, go, go! Go, Greaseman, go, go! Go, Alan, go, go! Bubbles we go. Sit beneath the tree by the railroad track. Oh, investors see him sitting in the shade, strumming with the rhythm that the rate cuts made. People passing by would stop and say, oh my, the bubbles keep getting bigger each day. But blow, blow, Alan, blow, blow. Go, Alan, go, go. Go, Bernanke, go, go. Go, Yellen, go, go. Bubbles, they go.
Sakes, look at this, folks. Surprise guest appearance was Ben Bernanke. Thanks for joining me here. And Janet Yellen. They come here to blow some bubbles on it. It is Janet Yellen on the sax and Ben Bernanke on the sax. Look at him blow bubbles. Ben, you still got the talent. And look, he brought me this fantastic bubble blowing machine. Let's get it.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.